It is a Wednesday morning, 7:41 here on the Mighty 690. That means it's time to talk with the fine folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We have Adavin and James joining us this morning. How are you doing?
Doing good, thank you. Good deal.
So, Adavin, we're going to start with you. You have some events coming up, is that correct?
Yes, we have a couple events coming up. Well, we'll be having a lot of events coming up after the new year, but I just wanted to highlight a couple that will be kind of the first ones that we'll be kicking off. And one of the first ones is Calving School, and it will be Thursday, January 12th at 6 p.m. at the Old Iron Club in Fredonia, and they do ask that you RSVP by January 4th to help them get a meal count. It's free to attend, thanks to sponsors who are paying for the meal, and you can RSVP by calling our Fredonia office at 620-378-2167, and this is a really cool workshop. I've heard. I haven't been able to attend
it
one yet,
fun.
So I'm excited about this one. Dr. AJ Tarpoff, KSU Beef Extension Veterinarian, is coming down, and he's bringing basically a cow replica. Is that kind of how you would describe it, James?
Big
to kind of
cow.
Walk people through like how to pull the calves, that sort of thing. And then the next one is actually a workshop series called The Power of Negotiation and Communication. And this is a land leasing strategy series. So I know a lot of people have questions about, you know, writing a lease, going through the leasing process for pasture or crop fields. We always get a lot of questions about it. So this four-part series will cover lease agreement basics, landlord-tenant relationships, negotiation and communication skills, and conservation practices. And it will be held for 4 weeks, January 18th and 25th, and then February 1st and 8th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. And we will be hosting this location in Cherokee, Edna, and Neodache. And then the Southwind District is hosting it in Erie. So you can choose which location to attend based on where you live, whichever one is most convenient for you. There is a registration fee of $50 for this workshop to help cover the cost of materials. Dinner is included every night. And we ask that you register for this workshop by January 13th by visiting agmanager.info/events. It will take you to the event page on Ag Manager, and then you just scroll through until you find the title of this workshop, which again is The Power of Negotiation and Communication. K-State's partnering with Nebraska Extension and Purdue University Extension for this workshop. So they'll have a lot of great speakers, and then they'll also will be covering local information as well on leases. And when you go to the Ag Manager website, and in our advertising material, because of the grant they got, it is titled for Midwestern Women in Ag, but this workshop is open to everybody.
Okay,
men and women
sure.
are both welcome to attend.
Well, that's good. Good deal. That sounds like a really good topic. You know, we were talking, James, a couple weeks ago, I think, about some of this topic, and I think it's something that we really do want to focus on, because I learned a lot just from our conversation the other day. So, well, Adavin, you said you wanted to discuss milk fever. Is that right?
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about milk fever and pregnancy toxemia, which sometimes is also called ketosis. Those terms are used interchangeably. And these are two sicknesses that can affect all types of livestock. I'm going to be focusing more on sheep and goats this morning, because that's kind of where the majority of my background and experience is from. And so these are two things producers may come have to deal with when their sheep and goats are in late gestation, getting close to kidding and lambing, or right after they kid and lamb. So milk fever typically is only a concern for dairy goats or does and ewes that produce a lot of milk. Milk fever is when their body isn't able to activate enough calcium. So that could be caused by them not getting enough calcium in their feed. And on the flip side, it can also be caused by them getting too much calcium in their feed. And when they kid or lamb and their body, their hormones kind of trigger the response of, hey, we need to let more milk down. We need more calcium to do that. They won't kind of release that calcium from their stores because they think they already have enough because they've been getting high amounts in their diet. So signs of that are does and ewes being really lethargic, having a low temperature, being weak, having trouble standing up. So those are all signs to watch for. And if you notice a goat or a sheep that's exhibiting those signs and symptoms, giving them calcium is the treatment for it. You can give them calcium in a paste form, which is called CMPK. You can also give them a sub-Q injection, which is an injection under the skin of calcium. And in really extreme cases, they'll need an IV injection of calcium. So that's definitely going to be something you want to work with your vet for treatment on. Now, pregnancy toxemia or ketosis, I wanted to highlight because it also happens in late gestation of goats and sheep, and it's caused by the does and the ewes not getting enough energy in their feed. And when those kids and lambs are growing, most of fetal growth takes place in that last month of pregnancy. So that's when their energy needs are going to be the highest. But of course, those kids are growing. So their rumen, which is where they digest all their feed, is also has the smallest amount of capacity because those kids have gotten so big. And this year, unfortunately, because it's been so dry, the hay is a lower quality this year. Pastures has been a lower quality. So if the main source of nutrients for sheep and goats have been from pasture and hay, they're not going to be able to get as much energy out of it this year. So I just wanted producers to be aware, kind of be watching for those symptoms, really consider if they're not doing so already, supplementing goats and sheep with a grain ration that has higher energy to meet their demands during this stage of their production cycle. And then signs of pregnancy toxemia are actually pretty similar to ketosis. They'll act depressed, be slow moving, in more advanced cases have trouble standing up. So if you go out to feed and check on them and you notice one that's really lagging behind or not coming up to eat, you definitely want to check her temperature. Sometimes in ketosis, they'll have a normal temperature. I've treated does before that their temperature is normal, but they're not coming up to eat. They're moving really slow. And ketosis, once it gets a little bit more advanced, they'll have a sweet smell to their breath or to their urine. That's like the telltale sign of ketosis or pregnancy toxemia. And it's a super, super like sickening sweet smell. And that's when you really know that that's what you're dealing with. But hopefully you're able to catch it before it reaches that point, because then it's easier to treat them, get them back up on their feet and back to normal before they kid or lamb. So the other sign is they'll act really tender when that their feet are really tender when they walk. Sometimes their pasterns will get swollen. So if you watch them walk, they'll put weight on their hooves, but they'll slowly like set their hooves down before they put their full weight on that hoof and act like they're kind of walking kind of gingerly, that they're not real sure of their footing. Is another sign of that. And to treat this, you know, there's different energy sort of drenches that different breeders have come up with during the years. But you can get a gallon jug of propylene glycol, which is basically it's kind of a syrup, has a lot of sugar and energy in it, and drench them with that to kind of boost up their energy and get them going again. And if you have one come down with this when they're very close to kitting or lambing, you also want to be paying really close attention to them, because they don't have enough energy, they might need help delivering those kids or lambs.
What do you actually mean when you say drench?
Oh, great question. Yeah, great question. So drench is when you get, so they make drenching guns, or you can use a really big syringe. And basically it's just a really big syringe with a narrow tip on it. And you put that into their mouth, and then you push the liquid with the plunger of the syringe into their mouth, so you kind of make them swallow it, because a lot of times they won't be eating, they won't be feeling good.
Okay, sure, gotcha. And then also the question of like dosing on that calcium, would that be, that is that paste available at like a feed store or whatever, and is it pretty standard as far as the dosing goes?
Yeah, so the paste, sometimes it's available at feed stores or the co-ops, sometimes it's not. So it's something that you want to check on, because it's not that expensive, so it's something good to buy and have on hand. And typically it comes in a really big tube, because it's made for cattle, and you get kind of like a caulking gun that goes on the tube to administer it. And you're talking about 10 cc's, which is about like a full click. Or if you're not able to get one of the big caulking guns to put it on, you can take it and put it in, again, a syringe that has a catheter tip on the end of it, and give it to them that way. And then if you have one that's in worse shape and needs the calcium injections, that's when you're definitely going to want to be in contact with your vet, because they'll have those supplies and you'll want to work with them on the administration and dosage of that.
Okay, very good. Well, any other thoughts on either of these topics here?
That's kind of all I have.
No, that's great. No, it's good information, and it's just good for people to be keeping an eye out, being aware, that sort of thing, and knowing what to look for.
Yeah,
you know, they can't tell you. They can't tell you what's going on.
And that's definitely like, when, if you're able to go out and check on them every day, you'll kind of get a feel for what's normal for the different animals in the herd. If it's one that's always like right there first to the feed trough and it's hanging back, that's a lot of times a sign that they're not feeling quite right, that something's up.
Sure, absolutely. Well, we are heading towards the top of the hour here, but coming up, appreciate that, David. I'll always learn something when you're on a course. We will be talking a little wheat crop, a little red cedar, that sort of thing with James Coover. So that is on the way here on the Mighty 690, 29 degrees right now in Coffeyville. 810 back here. I'm looking at 10s. With the K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, we have David and James in the studio, and James Cooper, crop agent. You know, we gotta always talk about winter wheat.
Yeah, of course.
This time of year.
Yeah, it's the only thing growing.
The deer are enjoying it. They're out there in full force.
Oh,
I saw
a
dozen back behind my place there. They're just going crazy. And of course with hunting season, you know, they're fleeing to places that they know that the hunters aren't.
They're all getting all jostled up right now, so we're seeing a lot of them. And of course, you know, be careful out on the roads.
Oh my gosh, I was in Liberty actually last night, and there was, you know, five of them just right there on the road. I'm always like, when I don't know what to do, like to let people know behind me, I'm like tapping my brakes or whatever. I'm just like, hey, there's just something up here. Be aware.
Yeah.
Because especially with this fog, I was super paranoid. I was like, oh my gosh, they're going to jump out and we're going to be screwed. But anyway, what's up with the wheat right now?
You know, the deer are enjoying the wheat because the wheat looks good right now, actually. And so, I mean, obviously we were kind of worried about it because it was super dry until the beginning of October. We finally got some rain, got some wheat germinated. And so far, we're doing pretty good. We keep getting pretty timely rains, as most everybody knows. Right now, the soil profile is fairly full. I mean, we could still fit some more rain in there, but it's fuller than I was expecting, honestly, at this time of year. And so, you know, but it's not so wet that the wheat is drowning, which is usually what happens here in southeast Kansas. It's actually suffering because it's too much and it can't breathe. So this year, it's actually been really nice. Honestly, we kind of need to just like taper off just rain just a little bit. And so that way we can kind of carry on because it's just about to go dormant. Next week when it gets into the teens, that's when the tops start to die off. Well, not die off, but brown out, basically, and they go dormant. I'm not worried at all about the cold temperatures next week hurting the wheat. They are fully vernalized at this point. They can probably take temperatures in the negatives, honestly. Wow. And so they are ready for what's to come.
So just like in the forecast, it's looking like that's actually going to kind of ring true. Where it's going to be colder, but it doesn't look like we have a rain in the forecast for the next several days. So
yeah.
It looks like that'll be in our favor.
Yes, and it's favorable that we actually have so much water in the soil right now because that helps buffer the temperatures. So without that, it would actually be much worse because then that cold gets down much deeper. As long as we're protecting that little, you know, the growth point an inch below the soil surface on that wheat, we're doing good. So, you know, and for the most part, the wheat will, it'll come back. Here in southeast Kansas, it kind of grows a little bit all winter. As long as the soil at the growth point is above 40 degrees, it'll either send out roots or it'll do something all winter long.
That's good to know because, yeah, especially if we have maybe, because we oftentimes do have a little stretch where it'll be above average temperatures and we get up in the 50s for a little while or that sort of thing and then drop back down.
Yeah. And so as long as it doesn't get too warm and it comes out of winterization, I mean, it'll be fine. I mean, it'll be growing. You know, it won't expand its tops too much over the next 2 months, but it will stick in there. So, we're doing good. The wheat, the corn and soybeans didn't look so good last year, but our wheat, we're still right on target. So, you know, good news so far.
What about conditions that you've seen here in southeast Kansas? How is the actual crop looking as far as the fields and everything?
Yeah. So here in southeast Kansas, I mean, we probably have some of the best looking wheat, honestly. I mean, up farther north on the basically eastern Kansas on the north side, it looks pretty good too. Honestly, it's hard to compete with them sometimes.
Oh yeah, but we were pretty much tied. I mean, the report that came out, I think last week or the week before, as far as percentage that had emerged, we were at like 90%.
Yeah,
a couple
we're
weeks
doing
ago.
Fantastic. And so, really, the only part of the state that's doing real bad with wheat is the western Kansas. They have not got any rain. It's been real cold. Their wheat looks dismal, honestly. At least from other ag agents are saying across the state. And it's already way too late. And so they might be able to put some wheat or some other crop in, you know, in the February timeframe, but it's already gone. So what are they going to do? They're just basically just waiting and collecting soil moisture at this point to do something else next year. So,
sure.
You know, but besides that, you know, I want to talk a little bit about wheat, but I also want to talk about red cedars.
And this is kind of a Christmassy topic.
Yes.
It's great.
And so, you know, so red cedars are basically the cedar that you see everywhere. If you see a wild evergreen out there anywhere, it's going to be a red cedar. That's all we've got. I mean, maybe if something escaped from somebody's yard, but not really. It's going to be red cedar.
And how did these get here? Were they native or?
They are native, actually. So they are our only native evergreen tree is the red cedar.
Okay.
They were not prolific like they are now. I mean, now they're everywhere. But they used to just be basically in the hilltops and the rocky areas where the fires on the plains couldn't get to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in very protected areas. And, you know, the Native Americans actually had some sort of association with them, too, because of what they were. And so, you know, the red cedars, it's actually not even a cedar. Mm. It's the Latin name is like Juniperus virginiana, and it's actually a juniper. And so, but a lot of cedars are confused for junipers and vice versa, back and forth. Most junipers are these tiny little bushy things.
Yeah.
But ours is huge. Actually, these red cedars, they can get incredibly tall. And so the state champion is 63 feet tall. If you can imagine how tall a red cedar is,
good
at
grief.
63 feet. And it's here in southeast Kansas. It's outside of Neodesha.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So,
is there like a, does that, is it wearing a sash or a ribbon?
They can go- maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen
like
it.
Like state champ.
Yeah.
State champ 2022.
Yeah. So, there's a number of state champions around here, actually.
That's excellent.
And so, and I think Jesse just did one for an Osage Orange that's in Parsons. So
I love
it's
it.
It's fun.
There's someone calls in, hey, I think I got a state champ here.
Yeah.
Send someone quick.
That's exactly what they do. They actually, you know, they do a thing. And they calculate this number that somehow makes it a state champion.
Awesome.
So junipers or red cedars. Red cedars are also male and female, which is kind of uncommon. Mostly in the mulberry family they do that, but red cedars do too. And so there's different colors during time of the year. Some of them will be like in different shades. They'll be like, you know, reddish or whatever. That's because it's actually a different sex of the tree. And so the males have like these little cones on it with pollen. The females have the little blueberries if they're old enough to do that. They are pretty good for wildlife, but in limited numbers. And so the blueberries, you know, birds will eat those. And then that's, of course, how they get spread throughout the fields, too. So they can provide cover for deer, but only in limited amounts. And so there's a certain amount of trees where eventually if you get to the point where there's too many cedars, deer will avoid them because they can't see anything. And so they can't see predators or whatever it is. They don't like too much cover. And so it's kind of more a Damon's area. But the quail are okay with them too, as long, again, as there's not too many. Because if the tree gets too tall, basically it's not covering enough on the ground. But also, if you have a whole bunch of these trees, they restrict the grass around them and the broadleaves around them. And so what ends up happening is you don't have enough food, basically, for the deer that like broadleaves and brush, and the quail that like, you know, seeds and other little things. So they're good for cover, but not nearly at the ratio that we have in a lot of our pastures, honestly. And so, you know, that restriction that they have on the grass, basically it's a chemical that they exude, also because it's a very shading plant.
Sure.
It's not terribly great, honestly, in the numbers that we have. So.
Well, and Brian was just saying, actually, that red cedars around here rot from the inside out. Have you seen any of that? And the big ones actually can be hollow.
Yes. That's very common. There's actually a number of species that do that. But red cedars, they do have a tendency to... basically, you'll see like a hollowing on the inside, and eventually some windstorm will crack out the top of them.
Yep.
It doesn't always kill them. Usually, it just mangles them. It makes them look ugly, but they'll stick around. And so, you know, it'd be better if it took them out entirely, the giant ones. But
now, do we consider these? I mean, cause sometimes I've helped out with like eagle projects and before cutting some of these down. Can they be considered invasive, or I mean, how do you cross that line?
Yeah, that is a hard line to cross because they are native, but in so many places we could consider them to be invasive because there's entirely two of them. They are a plant of first succession, and so basically you have a field that you're not managing, they'll be one of the first tree species, along with like hackberry and some of the other ones. You know, I guess you Bradford pears, even though they're not native, but they are literally everywhere, and they are spread by birds. Honestly, most times they kind of need to be controlled in a much better nature than what we do, especially farther north. And so down here we have so many invasive trees, it's hard to, you know, say one way or the other. But farther north in the plains and the Flint Hills and all that, red cedars are a much bigger issue.
Okay. So. And I mean, they are being spread like by birds and everything, like you said, that they're just, it's not like they're walking around.
Yeah. They get pretty much everywhere. Yeah. And I mean, they're good with any location that you put them in. And so they don't mind swamps. They don't mind rocky hilltops. They can deal with drought. They're a very persistent species.
Now, and actually, that could be a good windbreak. You know, I would think if you're, especially, you know, if you get out of Western Kansas, if you're living out there, you have to have a windbreak.
Yes.
Otherwise, you will lose your mind.
Yes.
So I've seen people, you know, plant those, you know, around their house to just try to block that just horrendous wind out there.
It's hard to beat them when it comes to windbreaks. I mean, because they're pretty maintenance free, you know, they can deal with our droughts sometimes, and they grow pretty fast too. And so they do get bagworms, but a lot of our pines get bagworms, and so you still have to spray them every once in a while. But there's really no other tree. There are some other pines that we can use. So I'll say that right now, there are other pines that we can use, but it's hard to be a cedar when it comes to a windbreak for cows or for, you know,
the house
house or whatever. And so that's why you see them everywhere, honestly. And that's where a lot of our cedars end up getting spread from originally too. And so,
bringing this all home to Christmas, I was making the joke a couple days ago, actually, about using red cedar for a Christmas tree. I mean, it seems like it would be a bad idea. I mean, they're all pokey and rough and that sort of thing.
Yeah, they're not the best Christmas trees, but they are free, pretty much, right? It's hard to beat free. They are literally everywhere.
Yeah.
And we need some sort of reason to naturally control them. So there you go. You know, and I mean, you're driving around down the highways and there's just cedars all over the place. Usually the best looking cedars are the ones that are in an unmanaged field. They're not like, they don't have any understory that they're trying to grow in.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, every right of way that's unmanaged is going to just be filled with these trees. And so obviously you need permission if you're going to go somewhere, but honestly, most places, I don't think they would care. I don't know anybody that would care if you cut down a cedar tree or two. So they're a little invasive, and very prolific. And so, you know, it'd be better for nature if we cut a bunch of them down, honestly. Mm-hmm. So if we just reduced them down, maybe like, I don't know, 90%, it'd probably be better for nature, honestly, and for wildlife. But it's kind of where it is at this point.
And considering, honestly, people are trying to save money. And I mean, the Christmas tree farms are fun. Kids like them and that sort of thing. But
yeah.
You're not going to walk out of there without spending like 100, 150, yeah, 200 bucks sometimes.
Yeah. Trees are expensive.
It's always,
because they're always imported, and it's hard to import a giant tree like that.
And we were saying there's actually, you know, not too many tree farms that you know of around here.
Yeah.
You know, I know there was one in, you know, in Arkansas. I know there's some in South Central Kansas.
Yeah, there are a few. Uh-huh. Yeah. But probably not enough to be the number of trees that we need.
No, and I mean, you think about, you know, it's going to be kind of those more one-off things. They're not going to, because it's going to take a while still to grow some of these trees, and I don't actually know what pines are really going to work well in this area.
Yeah, I mean, you can grow those Scots pines, which is a very common Christmas tree. The white pines, the really soft ones.
I like the white pines.
Yeah, the white pines. You know, those all can grow around here, but this isn't the perfect environment for them, so you got to baby them, honestly.
Sure. Yeah,
you know,
that's time and effort and money, and so I can see why they have to charge these prices. It just makes sense.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, cedar trees, they don't have the best form, like the nice, pretty form all the time. There's a lot of variation in cedar trees, though. Some of them look a lot better than others, and so if you're driving around, actually, there's like there's a different variation in Montgomery County, I've noticed, that are like very much more Christmas tree shaped than there are other places. But I think it's because a lot of them have escaped from people's yards and stuff, and so that's why some of them look a lot better than others, basically genetically. But you know, if you're gonna cut one down, wear gloves. They are very pokey. They're not the best, but you know, pretty good.
Great. Well, and David, you said that's what you have for this Christmas, right?
Yeah, it is. We cut our Christmas tree down over the weekend, so picked one out of the pasture.
Yeah, we did, and I think ours was probably too tall. I mean, honestly. we have a vaulted ceiling, and so I can get whatever one. They always look smaller in the pasture.
Isn't that weird?
So, just so you all know, maybe to bring a tape measure or something, they look smaller in the pasture. So
it is really odd how, whenever you're looking at that, once you get it inside, it's like, this is completely different than I was expecting.
Yes, yeah. We went a little overboard this year, so
sorry. Yeah, that's what Christmas all about. And hey, if it's got a little brown spots, then a little spray paint can't fix it.
There you go. Yeah.
Take care.
Just trim it out.
Absolutely. Get the hedge trimmer outside. Uh-huh. If it's not that nice triangular shape that you want, make it.
There you go. Yeah. If you're gonna put it against the wall, just cut off the back side.
Lop off the back.
Yeah. You don't need it all pretty.
Cut to fit. So.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. All right. Well, always good to have you guys on. I always say this every time. I learn a lot, but I really do, and I know that our listeners enjoy it, so really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
All right, yeah, a couple events, like you said, coming up. We'll make sure we promote those throughout the week as well. Let people know about that, and we'll get started with an early bird edition of Open Line coming up 2 at 9:10. We have Candy Westbrook from the Coffeyville Chamber of Commerce coming in. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.